Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, October 27, 2016, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's teleforum conference call on Chevron and the Circuit Courts. My name is Nate Kazmarek. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we welcome our experts, Professor Kent Barnett, Associate Professor of Law, University of Georgia School of Law, Professor Chris Walker, Associate Professor of Law, The Ohio State University Moritz College of Law, and we also have our moderator today, Stephen Vaden, who is an associate at Jones Day. Today, I will turn it over to Stephen Vaden to get us started. Following opening remarks, we will open the floor for questions. Thank you for speaking with us. Stephen, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Nate. And as he mentioned, today's teleform is entitled Chevron in the Circuit Courts. Recent opinions from the Supreme Court and policy debates within the halls of Washington have placed a renewed focus on the amount of judicial deference administrative agencies receive when interpreting statutes. The article that we'll be discussing today, Chevron and the Circuit Courts, examines the effect empirically that Chevron has, along with its weaker cousin Skidmore, on cases heard by the federal intermediate appellate courts. The article features circuit and agency-specific data on when and where Chevron really matters. If you're interested in reading the article in full, which if you're a practitioner of appellate law or interested in the area for academic or other reasons, you absolutely should, a link to the article on SSRN was included in the email announcing today's teleform. You can also find a link on the Federalist Society blog on the post that originally noted the Chevron and the Circuit Courts article, and the article itself will be available in the forthcoming 115th volume, first edition of the University of Michigan Law Review. So you have a wealth of opportunities to read it. Now, before we start, in case there's anyone on the call, which I'm certain there is, who is not familiar with Chevron or may have last heard about it during when they were in law school, I'm going to briefly explain what the Chevron doctrine is. The Chevron doctrine is easily the most important doctrine in administrative law. Basically, what it involves is that when federal courts look at rules issued by agencies interpreting statutes, they ask two primary questions. The first question that they ask, known as Chevron Step 1, is whether the statute the agency is interpreting is ambiguous. If the statute is not ambiguous and is subject to only one interpretation, one possible interpretation, then the agency rule must be the same as what that interpretation is, or it will be invalid. On the other hand, if the statute that the agency is interpreting is ambiguous, then the court moves to what's known as Chevron Step 2, where they determine whether the agency's interpretation is reasonable, not necessarily whether the agency's interpretation of the statute is the best possible interpretation. If the court determines that the agency's interpretation of the statute is reasonable, then the court will allow the rule to stand. Now, what you may note about this is that as long as the agency's interpretation of an ambiguous statute is reasonable, the agency becomes the primary interpreter of the statute rather than the courts. And that has led to all sorts of issues which are currently in the forefront as a raft of rules have come through the administrative state, particularly in the past 8 years. And that brings us to today's speakers who are going to tell us why we should care about Chevron and what effect it has at the Federal Circuit Courts of Appeal. Our first speaker is Kent Barnett. He's an associate professor at the University of Georgia Law School, where he teaches administrative law, contracts, and consumer law. His scholarship focuses on the separation of powers and judicial review in the federal administrative state. And you can find his scholarship in the New York University Review of Law, the Michigan Law Review, and the Vanderbilt Law Review, among others. He's been cited by federal trial and appellate courts, and he has been selected for presentation at the 2014 Annual Conference of the Southeastern Association of Law Schools. Before coming to the University of Georgia, Professor Barnett taught at the University of Kentucky College of Law and also clerked for Judge John Rogers of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. Professor Barnett also practiced law at Weil Gotshal in its complex commercial litigation and appellate groups. Our second speaker this afternoon will be Professor Christopher Walker. He is a law professor at The Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. Prior to joining its law faculty, Professor Walker clerked for Justice Anthony Kennedy of the United States Supreme Court and worked on the civil appellate staff at the U.S. Department of Justice. His publications have appeared or are forthcoming in the Michigan Law Review, the Stanford Law Review, and the University of Pennsylvania Law Review, among others. When he's not busy teaching classes in law school or writing articles, he serves as one of 40 public members of the Administrative Conference of the United States and as a council member of the American Bar Association's Section on Administrative Law and Regulatory Practice. And we thank both of you for joining us here this afternoon on the teleconference. So I want to jump right into it and direct my first question to Professor Walker, and it is this. Do these doctrines, Chevron, Skidmore, do they actually matter? Now, a few years ago, in a seminal law review article written by Professor Eskridge of Yale Law School, he studied administrative cases before the Supreme Court and largely came to the conclusion that the doctrines, at least at the Supreme Court level, did not matter that much. Professor Walker, what did you find with regard to whether they mattered at the circuit court level?
So thanks, Stephen. It's so great to join the call. And Ken and I are obviously really, really excited to talk about this project. We've been spending the last 3 or 4 years on coding cases in the circuit courts to deal with Chevron, and this has become a bigger issue in the last couple years as judges, across the nation have started to express more skepticism about Chevron deference or more concerns about Chevron deference. And so you have, just this summer, a concurring opinion by Judge Gorsuch that kind of sets forth the constitutional challenge to Chevron deference. And you have Judge Kavanaugh on the D.C. Circuit in a Harvard Law Review book review expressing his concerns. And, of course, perhaps most importantly, you have Justice Thomas in Michigan versus EPA in his separate opinion or concurring opinion saying that he thinks that it also raises serious concerns. And that perhaps all culminated this last spring with the House and the Senate introducing legislation to get rid of Chevron deference. And so for some people in the academy and perhaps in the real world as well, the question that you raise is one that's seriously considered. Do these deference doctrines even matter? The legal realist might say that courts just decide what they think the ultimate answer should be, and then they kind of backtrack and apply whatever deference doctrine or say they're applying it, but it actually doesn't matter. And I think, as you mentioned, the Eskridge and Bear study from about 10 years ago at the Supreme Court level suggests that it doesn't. Ken and I, in looking at when we started this project, our intuition was that at the circuit level, it probably does matter quite a bit as opposed to the Supreme Court level. And while we're cautious in reporting findings in this first, more mainly descriptive paper, it seems like the findings seem to support that. So to kind of give you a sense, we looked at every single published circuit court decision over an 11-year period that mentioned Chevron. And so that was over 1,500 agency statutory interpretations. And looking at that data, when Chevron applies, agencies win about 77% of the time. And when Chevron does not apply, when they say, all right, we're not applying Chevron, there's nearly a 25 percentage point difference. Again, there's some methodological limitations here. We're only looking at cases where Chevron is cited, not cases where they don't. So you could imagine that some courts, if they don't want to apply Chevron deference, might not cite it in the opinion, although in our review of cases beyond that, it doesn't seem like that's too big of an issue. But there's some other warts in the as with any coding project. But the numbers are pretty compelling, at least to me. And if you want to kind of drill down a little bit more, so if they don't apply Chevron, If they apply Skidmore, they win about 56% of the time. And if they refuse to apply any deference, you plummet all the way below 40% of the time in the circuit courts. And so I think, and it shouldn't be a surprise to practitioners, I don't think, that the circuit courts take Chevron pretty seriously as an anchor, in favor of deferring to agency statutory interpretations.
And, of course, you looked at a total of 1,330 published federal court decisions over a 10-year period from 2003 to 2013. And as you noted, in those 1,330 published federal court decisions, they were looking at more than 1,500 separate agency statutory interpretations. So in some of those opinions, they were looking at more than one agency interpretation of a statute. And that's just over a 10-year period. So that when you compare the number of opinions issued by the federal circuit courts, and again, you limited it to published opinions, with how many administrative law cases the Supreme Court heard in that 10-year span, which is only a tiny fraction of that number, I think you reach the conclusion in your article that regardless of what may happen at the Supreme Court, at the circuit court level, which is where nearly all administrative law decisions are decided for a final basis, Chevron has true bite.
Yeah, and we're a little cautious. You know, this is the first paper we've brought on a great political scientist, Christina Boyd, for the next couple of papers in the series, where we're going to, start controlling for factors and seeing what is driving most of the work. And I hope on this call we can kind of talk about, those are the overall factors, but if you break it down by agency or circuit, you start to see different disparities. Not all circuits are the same, and definitely not all agencies are the same in the agency win rates.
But
that's a pretty big difference. 25 percentage point difference. This is a raw number. Suggests that Chevron has to be doing some work at the circuit court level.
Yes, and let's start to break it down. So earlier in the call, during the introduction, we mentioned that there are two steps to Chevron. At step one, the court asks, is the statute ambiguous? If the statute is not ambiguous, then the agency's interpretation has to match what the court determines the statute's interpretation to be. If the statute is ambiguous, we go to step two, and that is the step where the court will defer to the agency if the agency's interpretation is reasonable. You broke down your analysis of what happens at the different steps of Chevron and how the agencies fare in these 1,330 opinions. What did you find?
Yeah, and this is a great, if there are any administrative law professors listening, I hope this is included in your ad law class, your regulation class, is the stats. And similarly, if you're counseling clients or if you're at an agency, and this kind of big picture numbers, they confirm what we think, right? So if an agency, and which is basically what, always say to a client that, the whole ball game is at step one in Chevron land. It's about whether it's ambiguous or not, because once you get to step two, the agency almost always wins. And our survey revealed that, right? Or, our study revealed that nearly 94% of the time at step two, the agency is going to win. The court's going to say that the agency's interpretation is reasonable. If the case is decided at step one, in other words, if the court finds that the statute is unambiguous, the agency only wins about 40% of the time. To kind of provide a similar perspective, that's the same win rate as if the court was applying de novo review and decides that Chevron doesn't apply. And so as an agency, you know that once you get to step two, you're going to win. And similarly, if you're representing a client, you really got to make the argument that the statute is unambiguous and unambiguous in your favor, and so that's not a surprising finding, but one I think that can be used when you're counseling clients or when you're teaching students to kind of explain what's at stake at each of the steps of Chevron.
And that number that your study has revealed, that the agencies win 94% of the time at step two, would tend to lend credence to what Judge Kavanaugh, Justice Thomas, and other judges have found in their own opinions regarding their concern that federal courts are abandoning what they see as their constitutional role to state what the law is because of this doctrine, at least if the statute is ambiguous.
Yeah, I think that's right. Although I want to be, you know, a little bit careful. There's a little bit of a legal realist in me as well, right? I mean, we don't know why the judges actually are deciding this at step one or step two. I mean, there's definitely an alternative, you know, story that the judge is going to, you know, is going to, what step they use is going to depend on whether they want the agency to win or not as well, right? And so you could imagine it kind of coming out the other way, you know, along those lines, where the court is using is deciding which way the whether the agency should win or not, and then kind of backtracks to the steps. And there's really no way for us in reading the decisions to figure out what's in the minds of the judges. Although I will say it was not uncommon, you know, that the court would say, you know, that this is not the best interpretation of the statute, right? And not uncommon. I mean, it wasn't the predominant, but when you're at step two, where a court would say, you know, if we were reviewing de novo, we might reach a different conclusion, but we're not. It's an ambiguous statute. Agency's interpretation is reasonable. And so you do have some of those examples in the data set.
Now, Chris mentioned that not only did you find disparities based on what step of Chevron the court made its decision, whether it's step one or step two, but there were wide disparities between the circuits. And Kent, your article could be used almost as a forum shopping guide for a savvy practitioner if you have a choice about what circuit you wanted to file your suit in. What did you find about the disparities between the different circuits and how frequently they will apply or not apply Chevron?
This is where I think it gets really interesting when you start looking at the differences, because we see what we think is something meaningful from what Chris described as the difference in agency win rates between Chevron, Skidmore, and de novo review. But disaggregating the data by circuit really starts to complicate the story we're able to tell. So if we start with agency win rates overall under Chevron, under Skidmore, de novo review, we see quite a gap between the most, in other words, deferential circuit or the circuit most likely to find in favor of the agency and the agency that's least likely. The First Circuit leads by allowing the agency to win about 83% of the time, whereas the Ninth Circuit has the agency winning only about 65% of the time. We have debated what's causing some of this issue, and I think part of it's going to be subject matter, some of it's going to be valence of the political nature of the topic, and also some on panel effects. For instance, with the Ninth Circuit, we were talking recently about how many immigration cases the Ninth Circuit hears, and if you take out the immigration cases from the Ninth Circuit, its rate jumps up to about the mean or median circuit, about 71% or so. So there are various factors here. So if you're thinking about essentially engaging in forum shopping with this, you do have to be careful with the data that we're going to provide, but it can at least give you some intuition about how likely you are to be successful within that particular circuit. So as of just overall rates, we see a difference of approximately 20%. If we then turn and ask, how often do the agencies apply Chevron? We see similar disparities. The D.C. Circuit leads the way in applying Chevron almost 90% of the time, and there are some other circuits that apply it frequently too, the First Circuit and the Eighth Circuit, for instance. That may not be so surprising, especially with the D.C. Circuit, because it was an early adopter of Chevron, and indeed there's been an article, one of which was by Gary Lawson, that indicated it was the D.C. Circuit that really made Chevron Chevron, that understood it as a new doctrine and something that courts should use when reviewing administrative action. But other circuits may not have bought in quite so readily. The Sixth Circuit, to our surprise, only applied Chevron about 60% of the time. So you would have almost a 30% difference as to whether or not Chevron is going to apply between the D.C. Circuit and the Sixth Circuit. Once you go a step further and you ask, well, do the agencies win under Chevron once the courts have decided to apply it, this is, to us, I think, what became one of the more fascinating findings, that several of the circuits would show very high win rates under Chevron, even if it was hard to get Chevron. So the one that led that was the Sixth Circuit. There, the overall win rate was 69%, whereas the win rate with Chevron was 88.2%. Nearly 20 percentage points higher. And recall that the Sixth Circuit was the circuit least likely to provide Chevron. But once it did, it had the highest win rate under Chevron of almost 90%. And there are a few other circuits where we saw similar types of effects, like the Second Circuit and the Seventh Circuit. Conversely, the win rate differential was within 3 percentage points in 6 of the 13 circuits. So it would look like there that Chevron doesn't really matter between win rates under overall rates or under Chevron. But that may not be the correct inference from the data. For many of these circuits where there was little difference in the win rate, that's because the court applied Chevron almost as a matter of course at a high rate, that the Chevron win rate and the overall win rate were basically the same. And we attempted to tease out the nuances by comparing the win rate under Chevron with the win rate when Chevron does not apply. And the overall win rate when Chevron applied was 77.3%, as Chris mentioned. But when Chevron did not apply, the win rate plummeted down 24 percentage points to 53.4%. And once you looked at those six circuits whose differential between win rates altogether and under Chevron weren't significant, all of a sudden the numbers became quite different when you compared how agencies did under Chevron and not under Chevron. The difference in the D.C. circuit, for instance, was the highest, was over 20 percentage points difference. So Chevron, again, seems to be doing some work here, even if we can't say, based on the descriptive nature of the data, exactly how much or what kind of work it's doing.
Now, Kent, you even went further because you not only asked the question, how does it differ between the circuits, but you asked the question for each circuit, to what types of interpretations are agencies applying Chevron? So, in other words, are they limiting Chevron to more formal notice and comment rulemaking? Or are they applying Chevron to more informal rulings, some of which, if you look at certain Supreme Court cases, the Supreme Court might not be so supportive of applying the Chevron doctrine to because of its informality? What did you find regarding those statistics?
That's right. So we coded for the formality of the interpretation, and then we sought to see what kind of effects or outcomes we saw for those. And what was nice about our data set that I don't think we'd anticipated is that we've got a very nice division of the various kinds of agency action. So we have roughly a third of our interpretations were from notice and comment rulemaking. Roughly a third of them were from formal adjudication. And based on current doctrine, we would expect that they would be treated roughly the same. Mead suggests that they are, a case from the early 2000s. And then we also had one-third of just informal interpretations as well. And perhaps in light of this focus on procedural formality in Mead and some other cases, it shouldn't surprise that agencies win nearly three-fourths of the time when their interpretation is the product of notice and comment rulemaking or formal adjudication, but that win rate falls to 64.6%, so about 65%, when the agency uses less formal means. Okay, so that's an overall rate. But we also looked again at Chevron application rates to figure out if there would be any difference. And we found that the data are consistent with what one would expect from Supreme Court precedent in one respect, but not another. The findings are consistent with Mead in that the formal interpretations receive Chevron deference at higher rates than informal interpretations, but they are inconsistent with expectations that rulemaking and formal adjudication are treated the same. The circuit courts applied the Chevron framework to almost 93% of notice and comment rulemakings. And in formal adjudication, they applied Chevron deference in about 77% of the interpretation. So there is some difference there. We'd have a difference of roughly 15 percentage points. Not surprisingly, based on Mead and Christensen's preference for formal interpretations, the rate dropped significantly below 50% for informal interpretations. It was only 46% if we had an informal interpretation. But if we removed certain immigration decisions because they have an idiosyncratic review provision, then the awarding of Chevron's applications for formal adjudication jumped nearly 10 percentage point to 85%. So it's getting pretty close there to formal rulemaking. Well, then the same kind of question from above, what happens once Chevron applies? Well, this gets interesting too. For adjudications without immigration decisions, agencies prevail almost 86% of the time, so a very high rate. For notice and comment rulemaking, though, the win rate actually drops to 74.2%. The strangest finding that we found is that for informal interpretations, where I think one would intuitively expect for the agency win rate to drop, it's actually higher than notice and comment rulemaking. It's roughly 78%, so about 4 percentage points higher than notice and comment rulemaking. For this reason, we suggest in the paper that agencies may be better off starting to rethink some of the concerns with adjudication. And adjudication for agencies may end up being a decent vehicle for statutory interpretation.
Now, that's a particularly interesting finding regarding your study, where you found that formal adjudications were upheld more frequently than rules that were promulgated through notice and comment procedures. People who follow administrative law will know, particularly in regard to the Securities and Exchange Commission, but also other agencies, there has been a push to do more internally through formal adjudication, where they can have their own ALJs make case-by-case decisions, and almost in sort of a common law fashion, develop the rules and regulations that govern the agency's area of jurisdiction. There has been a lot of discussion in the legal community about whether or not this protects the defendants in those cases' due process rights. But what your study is finding, at least from the subset of cases that you looked at, if an agency is concerned about being upheld, doing more formal adjudication is potentially the way to go, and has the added benefit of escaping review of the White House's Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, as well as certain congressionally imposed constraints on rulemaking.
That's right, and it gives the agencies more flexibility, too. As you say, it's a common law type of legal development, so you can move incrementally. You don't have to think in such broad strokes. Well, of course, there are problems for regulated parties with that, too. You don't have as much notice, and then, as you say, there can be due process concerns, too, with how the proceedings are treated. One small note on that, just for anyone listening, when we're using the term formal adjudication, we defined it broadly to mean more than just those adjudications where there's an administrative law judge and proceedings under the Administrative Procedure Act. We're looking at adversarial type of proceedings where there's a hearing and a presiding officer, where parties, you know, typically are briefing and there's a written decision that's issued. But yes, acting in this adjudicatory format with some formality seems to behoove the agencies in interpreting their statutes.
And just to tie up a point that some people on our call may be wondering about, the one type of agency proceeding that we have not discussed, namely formal rulemaking, which takes place with a trial-type hearing, you basically found what many people familiar with administrative law have tended to believe. Those types of proceedings almost don't exist anymore.
Or at least are not making it to the courts for review. We only had, out of our 1,561 interpretations, four instances of formal adjudicatory style rulemaking.
So not really anything you can draw a conclusion from other than there are not many of them, or at least
exactly.
Not many of them in the court system.
Exactly. It's just such a small number that we just don't think we can draw significant conclusions from it.
Can I jump in? I just want to jump in on this adjudication point. This was, for Ken and I, this is kind of what launched our initial interest in doing this project several years ago, is I at least had the intuition that perhaps because adjudication doesn't have the public, like, you know, quasi-minimalist democratic feel of a rulemaking, of a notice and comment rulemaking, that perhaps circuit courts were going to be less likely to accord Chevron deference to these, you know, adversarial proceedings when they create for the first time a statutory interpretation in those than in others. And because of these concerns, although that's not the doctrine, the Supreme Court's never hinted that that should be a factor, I kind of thought it might be driving some of it. So I was actually quite floored to find out that that there is no difference, and if there is a difference at all, adjudication actually might be, you know, a better approach. Now, I want to be careful with this because, you know, another explanation that an agency would likely give is that maybe we're not as aggressive when we're advancing agency statutory interpretations of adjudication. And so, we can't really dig into that with the data that we have. You know, perhaps an agency would save its more aggressive approach to statutory interpretation for notice and comment rulemaking. It would be more careful and more cautious in an adjudication. We really can't see that. But what we can say, I think, safely from having read all of these cases is that the circuit courts aren't picking up any difference, at least in the opinions themselves, of saying, oh, wait, this is an adjudication, we've got to treat this differently. They're just looking at the interpretation itself and not focusing on the procedural difference.
Well, if the agencies do decide to be more aggressive in their use of adjudication, as some people in these agencies are advocating, you may in your next 10-year data set, if you extend your study, be able to test that theory as to whether or not there is any distinction between the two, or whether it is whether it was the agency's decision in prior years to hold their most aggressive cases back from adjudication. That might be an area that you could test. The last point that I want to get to, and Chris, I'll address this to you, is as hard as it may be for our listeners to believe, you drilled down even further in this study. You not only looked at what step of Chevron courts decide cases based on and how those percentages work out, you not only divided it up by circuit and the formality of the decision, but you also went and looked at agency win rates, individual agencies, and how they do in terms of how often Chevron is applied and how often they win. And you came up with a list of agencies that do pretty well in the federal courts and agencies that do absolutely dismally in the federal courts. What did you find?
Yeah, so this is fun. this was probably my favorite part. And we have a lot more work to do because we've really got to be able to control for some other stuff, but you know, certain agencies that I had always kind of had an impression that the FCC lost a lot in court, just generally, and yet they're one of the most with respect to agency statutory interpretations, they're one of the biggest winners. With respect to agency statutory interpretations, they win, you know, over 80% of the time, and when Chevron applies, they win nearly 90% of the time. Now, granted, for those that do work in that space, part of the answer is that a lot of the actions where the FCC loses are on, you know, State Farm, you know, arbitrary capricious review, and so you might not be looking at the issue of statutory interpretation. But I found that pretty fascinating. On the flip side, it doesn't surprise me that, you know, the EOC is the biggest loser. You know, if you follow the Supreme Court, deference is not given to the EOC of agency statutory interpretations. That's also somewhat of a nature of its statutory mandate. And that also the IRS is near the bottom of the list, again, doesn't surprise me too much. For a long time, you know, there was a debate of whether even Chevron applied to Treasury regulations in the tax context, and it wasn't until the Mayo decision by the Supreme Court. But then there's kind of some fun, you know, looking at agencies that do similar work. Like the EPA is about right in the middle of the pack with respect to how often they win and how often that they get deference, whereas energy is one of the worst. It's kind of an interesting divide I haven't thought about. Another one that's one of the bigger winners is the NLRB. It seems a little counterintuitive. You think that they lose a lot, but they're higher up.
That's one you also think about where there are, particularly with changes in administration, vast swings in the changes in the NLRB opinions. They got diametrically opposed opinions, and yet your study found, which transited 2003 to 2013, so encompassing both the George W. Bush administrations and the first Obama administration, that the NLRB was one of the best, had one of the best win rates in the federal courts.
Yeah, and I want to be a little careful here. I mean, for those that litigate or study the NLRB, there are a lot of cases in the circuit courts where there's precedent that's developed that's a substitute for Chevron or shorthand, and I think NLRB is one context where there is they're relying on other citing other cases for deference, and so we might not be picking up, you know, the full picture here. But even that said, it's surprising to me at least to see them that high up.
Well, Nate, we have laid a lot of data before our audience here this afternoon, and I think it's only fair that we open it up to them to ask any questions that they may have of Professors Walker and Barnett.
Excellent. That sounds like a good idea. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone keypad. Before we go to calls, I do want to make one programming note. Our next Teleform conference call will be Friday, October 28th. I guess that's tomorrow at noon. That call will discuss race-based admissions and cover student lawsuits against Harvard and UNC. The call will feature William Consovoy, who is the lead attorney for the Students for Fair Admissions. Again, if you'd like to ask a question now, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone. Stephen, it doesn't look like we have any questions yet. Maybe we could continue with the discussion and then give our audience
Kent,
an opportunity.
Kent, I wanted to talk a little bit more about the so the last part of our paper has a lot of, I think, kind of fun, a little bit more nerdy theoretical points about, you know, the scope of Chevron and what's doing the work and not. But I think there's one that is worth talking about from a litigation perspective. And that's the idea of, like, longstanding interpretations. And I don't know, I mean, Kent's spent more time on this than I have. I don't know, Kent, if you want to kind of walk through some of those findings real quick. Or
sure. I mean, I think we thought this may be one of the more interesting ones. And as you say, if you're litigating, certainly a criterion that you should be considering. I'll start with these the way that I was thinking about some of the other ones. If you look at the overall agency win rate, longstanding interpretations do phenomenally better from the agency's point of view than what we coded as recent new interpretations, evolving ones where there was a changed interpretation from one prior agency interpretation, or of unknown duration. So, for instance, if it was longstanding, the agencies prevailed almost 82% of the time. But if it was evolving, recent, or unknown, everything dropped to an agency win rate of below 70%. And for some of those, such as evolving ones, it dropped below 60%. So you would see a 20% difference. Then with Chevron applicability rates, this one surprised me. Under Chevron and its framework, Chevron is supposed to apply to recent interpretations, evolving interpretations, and longstanding ones. Indeed, in Chevron itself, it concerned an evolving interpretation where the agency was replacing one interpretation with another. What we found was that courts applied Chevron to 76% or so of longstanding interpretations, and the surprise came with evolving interpretations. We didn't think that the circuit courts might necessarily follow the Supreme Court's guidance, but we found that they were applying Chevron deference even more frequently to evolving interpretations, almost 86% of the time. Now, once we parsed that a little further to look at interpretations that were presumptively Chevron eligible because they had formal rule, they had either former adjudication or notice and comment rulemaking, the disparity disappeared. In other words, the circuit courts are treating evolving and longstanding interpretations the same for whether Chevron applies. But once Chevron applies, then the longstanding agency interpretations triumph again, especially over the evolving ones. The longstanding interpretations prevailed almost 88% of the time, whereas interpretations of a recent or unclear vintage only prevailed about 75% of the time. Evolving interpretations, on the other hand, only won for the agencies about 65% of the time. So that means the agency goes from winning longstanding interpretations almost 90% of the time to evolving interpretations only 65% of the time. And I think one of the things that we found most interesting from a theoretical point of view was that the court in Chevron noticed that Chevron made sense from its point of view because the agencies have more political accountability in deciding how to interpret a statute than courts do. So the idea was that Congress and the public and the president can all hold the agencies more accountable. If that is a driving force, you would expect evolving interpretations to do fairly well when there's, say, a change in administrations. But what we found was that when there was a change in administrations, the win rate for agencies went significantly down. The win rate was quite low. So what did we really derive from all of this continuity data? First, we thought that the circuit courts have followed Chevron's command that Chevron applies to all agency positions, whether changed, new, or longstanding. But once Chevron applied, interpretive duration seems to matter. Here, if it's longstanding, the agency is likely to fare better. Finally, if agencies are seeking to use evolving interpretations, they need to be mindful of how they frame them. Those that were framed as merely occurring because of political administration changes did not fare well. However, those that looked to changed circumstances, new facts, things of that nature, fared relatively well in the courts. So it's important not only from the agencies to think about how they're framing changed interpretations, but something to be noticing and cognizant of if you're litigating on the other side.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me a little bit of Justice Kennedy's opinion for the court in Encino this last term, where he says that you've got to provide you don't get Chevron deference if you haven't followed all the procedures, and the procedure in particular there is providing reasons for changing your positions. And then he says, and of course they have to be good reasons. And I'm wondering, even though Chevron says change in administration, but I wonder if now the court's kind of saying, all right, we've got to have more than just that's not a good enough reason. It'd be interesting to see if the lower courts are modeling that. Kent, the other thing I was saying when you were talking, we should cross-tab this with the Chevron steps. I'd be really curious to see where the longstanding nature is having the most effect. I mean, is it the courts are saying, oh, no, sorry, your new interpretation, it's not within the scope of, it's not at all ambiguous. They're kind of deciding on step one now. Or are they getting to step two and saying it's unreasonable? It'd be interesting to see. I don't remember off the top of my head from reading these cases, where it was doing most of the work. But it'd be interesting to kind of see, where are the agencies losing with more recent interpretations?
No, I agree. And, I think one of the things that's going to be difficult about even doing that, or why the cross-tabbing might actually be interesting, is because what we found, too, was that the courts do not refer very often to whether or not the longstanding nature of the interpretation or the lack thereof matters. We coded certain provisions to figure out whether they have expressed salience in the court's opinions. And what we found is the courts rarely refer to why they're deferring or not. But longstanding interpretations, for instance, only showed up as an expressed reason for deferring or not deferring about 10% of the time in cases. And I know Chris has been writing about this some lately. To me, that's really interesting because of some recent work that's been done by Aditya Bhamsai at University of Virginia, where he has a recent article that's forthcoming in the Yale Law Journal, where he says Chevron wasn't the typical common law way. It wasn't something that the courts merely developed from something that had been in long existence. Instead, courts traditionally, British courts and American courts, had considered two factors for determining whether to defer to agencies, its longstanding nature and its contemporaneity. And what we're seeing from our data is that longstanding interpretations may fare better. It's somewhere in the court's thought process, perhaps, but they're not expressing it. So it doesn't have the same kind of salience that the factor once had in both British and American courts.
Well, and to perhaps back that up a bit, Chris mentioned the Encino Motor Cars case from this past term. That involved an agency interpretation of a Fair Labor Standards Act rule that went back to at least 1978, but that the Obama administration sought to change when it came in, And one of the reasons why Justice Kennedy found for the Supreme Court majority that the agency had failed to give good reasons was it hadn't taken into account the longstanding reliance interest of automobile dealers in relying on the rule that had been in existence for nearly 40 years. So that would tend to support all that you have just said there about the importance of a rule being longstanding. And in that case, at least, Justice Kennedy giving some indication that it was that longstanding nature and in particular the reliance interest that had been built up by the automobile sellers who were not paying and had not paid for the past 40 years service managers overtime that led them to send it back.
Yeah, I like that point a lot, Stephen. And I think the idea of reliance interests actually doing the work here could be a plausible alternative explanation, right? If you have a longstanding interpretation, and it hasn't been challenged before, you know, you're already by kind of definition thinking that it maybe isn't as controversial. And then on top of that, the court's thinking about the reliance interest of Encino, whereas with an evolving interpretation, well, there it's a difference. And with a recent interpretation as well, you know, so you could explain this in a different way. And I think we're careful, you know, we don't want to read too much into the findings on the different factors the courts say, especially as Kant said, because they don't say much at all usually about the rationales for why they're applying Chevron. But there's something under the surface in our data that suggests that perhaps this longstanding nature is doing some work once Chevron applies.
Gentlemen, this is Nate. I'm just going to interrupt for a second. We do have two callers waiting patiently to ask a question. I wondered if it would be a good time to go to their questions now.
Absolutely.
Okay, very good. And just a reminder to our audience, if you want to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone keypad. Let's go to the first caller now.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you would go into a little bit more of the Mayo decision and why not the Treasury decisions were going to be interpreted with Chevron.
Sure. So I'll take that, Ken, if that. So,
sure.
So this is one of the, you know, with the agency findings, this is one area that I've written a lot on, and so it's an area I'm particularly interested in. You know, there are a number of regulatory contexts where agencies for a long time have kind of clinged to this administrative law exceptionalism view, that they're not bound by the Administrative Procedure Act, that the rules of administrative law don't apply to them. And tax is one of those. For a long time, tax practitioners and the IRS itself and the tax court as well, didn't think that the administrative law would apply. And so it wasn't until the Mayo decision by the Supreme Court that the Supreme Court clarified that the IRS even got Chevron deference for certain interpretations. And so before that, they were following a standard that was called the National Muffler Standard, and it was a different standard. And so I think, you know, when you're looking at that, it's not too surprising to me that the IRS, if you look at, they're the one of the biggest losers on Chevron applying, and our data, you know, goes back, I guess our data goes back to 2003, and it wasn't Mayo a 2001 decision? Let me see.
I'd have to check. I thought it was a little later.
Oh, it was a 2008. I can't remember now. Oh, no, I take it back. It's 2011. So it would make sense that Chevron's not being applied or even cited as much when there was still dispute among the circuits about whether it applied. But even then, you know, looking at the IRS and its interpretations, there still is, you know, quite a bit of, you know, debate about a lot of the interpretations they put forward. Now, granted, we're not catching some of the more exciting ones, the challenges coming up with respect to the Affordable Care Act. That's not in our sample, but it doesn't surprise me that they don't win that often and that they don't get Chevron deference either.
We have one person currently waiting to ask a question. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone keypad. One reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming
teleform calls. You can also consult our full schedule at the of upcoming teleform calls on the Federal Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded teleform calls you may have missed. Okay, let's go to our next caller who's been waiting patiently. Go ahead, caller.
Hi. I have a question that I think probably you answered already, but I will put it another way. Did you go into in detail the grounds for what courts would consider a reasonable interpretation? I'm saying that because in some other sorts of cases, plausible was sufficient. In other words, if there was even a shadow of some rationale that the government gave, it would be sufficient. Did the cases you looked at, did you distinguish between merely plausible and actually reasonable? The second part of my question is, did the cases show that there was any effort by the courts to look at cost-benefit, which is even if there was a longstanding rule, if something had shifted in the economy or something had shifted sufficient to render an agency's action ruinous, say, for a particular defendant, did that make a difference?
This is Kent. I can start on that. For the first question as to whether or not we coded for a difference between reasonable interpretations versus some lesser standard such as a plausible interpretation, no. What we did in our coding was code for whether or not the court applied Chevron or another deference doctrine. If it did apply Chevron, did it then resolve the case at step one, or did it resolve the case at step two? And then we coded for various factors that we thought might implicate why the court deferred or didn't defer, but we didn't distinguish between the grounds. What I would say, in just anecdotally having reviewed about half of the cases in our data set, that most of them would have used the word reasonable at some point when getting to the step two. And usually it was by that word that would let us know if the court wasn't clear, as it often wasn't clear, if it was in step one or step two, that would suggest to us that it's in a step two analysis. But I do recall seeing some versions of plausible and synonyms to that effect, but we would have coded those all as being resolved one way or the other under step two. And then on the cost-benefit side, we didn't code for that either, and Chris may have a different experience with it. I recall a few of those cases. Anecdotally, they seem to come more out of the D.C. Circuit than other circuits, but that also could be because many of those rules were of higher impact, where you would have seen the problem with the costs on the regulated party side. But I can't say it was something that I noticed as a matter of routine in either step one or step two analysis.
So unless there's another call, I'll jump in and just add a little bit more on the first question, that, you know, there are only 51 agency statutory interpretations in our data set where the agency lost at step two, right? So of the over 1,500 cases, it's a pretty small number, and at some point, Ken and I are going to have to write up a little, you know, little shorter symposium piece on this, because my recollection is, you know, at step two, there's this big debate: are there even two steps of Chevron? You know, what work is happening at step two? You know, how could an agency ever lose at step two? And I kind of have two different working theories based on having reviewed a number of these of 51 cases. One is that they're doing what Justice Kagan kind of wants them to do. That they're applying arbitrary and capricious review at step two, and so that's kind of one formulation. Another one that I remember seeing is that they're applying using statutory interpretation tools, but they're taking a harder look at the purposivist rationales for the interpretation and kind of guessing more. You know, is this really what Congress intended? And that seemed to be when they were actually striking down interpretations at step two, it seemed to kind of have one or two or a mix of those two. I don't know, Ken, if you saw other variants, if you remember seeing other variants on that step two.
The only thing that's somewhat similar to what you said with the arbitrary and capricious is I can recall a few, and I think especially in the D.C. Circuit, where the court didn't think that the agency had responded to concerns from the other side that they had known about prior to the litigation.
Yeah.
They hadn't engaged with whatever was problematic with the interpretation.
I remember a couple of those, too, and that does kind of sound more like what Justice Kagan would want, right? Let's weld in, you know, a little bit more of the arbitrary capricious for you. Now, after Encino Motor Cars, I mean, we've got, like, this other condition proceeding now. They've got to follow all the procedures, and, you know, arbitrary capricious for you arguably comes first now, which is interesting. So maybe that, you know, maybe for Justice Kagan, that just means step two doesn't do anything anymore, but...
Gentlemen, we are... getting closer, sort of running short on time, and we do have one more caller waiting. Let's go to that question now. Go ahead, caller. Well, I'm sorry we accidentally lost that caller. If you would like to ask a question, please do call back. Please enter star and then the pound sign. Oh, that caller called right back. Let's see if we can get them on the line here before the end of the hour. Yes, caller, go ahead.
Good afternoon. I appreciate the discussion and the data is very interesting. But my question is whether or not you looked into any of the attempts to challenge Chevron under 706, which Chevron itself kind of stepped around. I've seen this in a number of cases here in the 11th Circuit where I practice in the immigration area where some attempts have been made to mandamus under 706, where it directs the court to decide all relevant questions of law, et cetera. And I was wondering if your study came up with anything on those grounds. The cases that I've seen get around it by saying there's an adequate remedy under the APA, but then the court doesn't actually decide the questions of relevant law, and so neither mandamus nor the APA actually provide any effective judicial review.
Yeah, so I don't remember any cases where the circuit courts, you know, grappled with this. Now, I think Judge Gorsuch's concurrent opinion that came out just last year, so not our data set, you know, goes through that some. But I don't remember any case in our data set that tried to revive the 706, you know, you should be reviewing these de novo type arguments. Now, granted, there are a number of immigration cases that deal with criminal law, and those ones, the court would say, you know, we don't apply Chevron deference to agency interpretations of criminal law, and so those are actually not something we're looking at in this study when it's dealing with something like that. That's kind of already a separate issue. But yeah,
there's a Serrano case. I'll just give you a reference: 655 F 3rd 1260. It's in the 11th Circuit, and it actually is challenging an agency determination. It applies Chevron and denies mandamus on the grounds that the APA does apply and provides an adequate remedy. But then, of course, doesn't actually get around to overcoming the agency's interpretation. But anyway, I just provide that.
Interesting. I'll take a look at it.
Yeah, that's great. It's an interesting question, too. And honestly, I wish it had been at the forefront while we were doing some of the review, but I can't say I noticed anything else similar to it.
I mean, that's obviously where Congress, or better said, the Republicans in Congress are trying to go with the Separation of Powers Restoration Act, right? They're trying to revive, you know, that as a de novo review standard.
Okay, gentlemen, I think we have exhausted the questions from our audience. I'd like to give you an opportunity maybe for some concluding remarks if you'd like.
Sure. Well, thank you. Yeah, sure. Well, thank you all again for having us and for entertaining our discussion on these factors. You know, what I think we hope that this is used for is a way for not only academics but also for practitioners and agencies to be able to use this data to help figure out what Chevron looks like before we start thinking more about whether we want Chevron or how we want to improve Chevron. We've had quite the vacuum, at least in law schools and on the scholarly side, of really understanding what Chevron does in the circuit courts. We can all kind of make our guesses about it, but we're hoping through this data we're able to provide some guidance on here is Chevron on the ground, here's how it's actually being implemented by the courts that hear the most agency interpretations. And with that, those who are making policy that are furthering litigation and bringing challenges of different stripes have some more data behind them now to advance whatever that position is going to be.
Yeah, and I would just kind of add to that, you know, the kind of the bigger picture that we would have loved to spend 15 pages in the paper, but we were already up to 70 pages and we wanted people to pick it up and read it. But, you know, one of my bigger impressions from this, you know, is that Chevron and the circuit courts really is a rule and not a standard.
Yeah.
That it is, and if you're thinking about it from, you know, the seat of Chief Justice Roberts, or whoever is going to be the new swing vote on the court once the Ninth Justice is seated. You know, the Supreme Court's in an unusual position here because they've established a rule that actually is applied pretty well across circuits and has a constraining effect on the way that circuits act. And yet if the Eskridge and Bear study, if their data is still true today, that the Supreme Court doesn't have to apply Chevron and doesn't apply Chevron uniformly. This provides a way for the Supreme Court to actually exercise quite a bit of control over the lower courts without also giving up its control over the agencies. And so I think that's kind of a fun way, you know, to think about Chevron is that it matters a lot in the circuit courts. It shifts the power to the agencies at the circuit court level in a pretty dramatic fashion. And yet it still carves out the space for the Supreme Court to have more of a plenary review of agency actions on cases where it deems it important enough to take and decide. And I think that's kind of a fun, you know, fun way to look at it, that at the Supreme Court it might be a standard, but at the circuit level it definitely looks a lot more like a rule.
Well, very, very good, gentlemen. This has been a very interesting discussion. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Professor Kent Barnett, Professor Chris Walker, and a special thank you to our moderator, Stephen Vaden, for joining us today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.